Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Mark Walta, registration number 30990, on behalf of Derek Nicholas Johnson, the appellant in this matter. Under Colorado law, mentally ill and developmentally disabled defendants often are faced with a paradox. On the one hand, their mental health and developmental disabilities will rarely, if ever, supply grounds for suppression of statements elicited by the police during custodial interrogations. On the other hand, they will often find great difficulty placing any evidence of their mental illness or intellectual disability before a jury, regardless of the purpose for which it's tendered, unless they submit to onerous procedural requirements. In short, our law paves the way for the admission of incriminating statements made by mentally ill or developmentally disabled defendants to police, but throws up significant roadblocks to the admission of expert evidence that the defendant was mentally ill or developmentally disabled at the time the statements were made. Mr. Johnson's position is that the law in both regards is proceeding along the wrong track. I'll first address the suppression issue. There are obviously a number of statements at issue here, and there are various grounds asserted for suppression, and I can't even hope to scratch the surface of those issues in the time allotted. But in very broad terms, we assert that the trial court in this case, and Colorado courts more generally, have gone too far in minimizing the importance of mental illness or developmental disability in evaluating both the voluntariness of statements and the effectiveness of Miranda waivers. The Supreme Court's assertion in Kaiser, for instance, that a defendant's mental capacity, quote, should not be the only or even the primary factor in the trial court's analysis is illustrative of the gulf between existing law and scientific fact. Recent empirical studies demonstrate that mental illness and developmental disability are key in determining whether a defendant's statements are voluntary and the result of an effective Miranda waiver. And
Mr. Walter, let me just interrupt your argument by asking you, if you're asking us to reverse a defendant's conviction based upon existing law or based upon decisions we can make, or are we precluded to do so based on existing precedent from the Colorado Supreme Court?
Well, I don't think that the court has to alter the analytical framework, certainly, for addressing these issues. That's well settled. I think the problem is one of emphasis and weight in terms of the multi-factor totality of the circumstances objective analysis that the courts engage in. And the problem from our perspective is, and Kaiser is a fantastic example of this, is that there's slowly been an erosion in the law in terms of the weight to be given to a defendant's mental capacity, mental illness, developmental disability, whatever, you know, moniker you want to use. And there have been efforts to excuse or dilute the impact of that on a criminal defendant's ability to either affect an effective waiver of his or her Miranda rights, or the extent to which the defendant is subject to coercion in making those statements in a custodial setting. So the short answer to your question, Judge Talman, is that I don't think the court has to do anything radical in terms of rejiggering the analysis necessarily, but the court can recognize, certainly based on the empirical studies that we've cited, based on the expert's own testimony in this case, that a defendant's developmental disabilities, and in this case also mental illness, has a dramatic impact on their ability to both understand the Miranda warnings and to execute a constitutionally effective waiver of their rights under Miranda.
So it sounds though like you're asking us to just simply accept the expert's testimony, but that expert was cross-examined, and it seems to me that some of her conclusions were undercut by that cross-examination, or at least that the trial court was allowed to determine that. I mean, we're reviewing a factual determination here.
Sure.
As to what he was able to perceive, whether he was able to act voluntarily, those sorts of things.
We've obviously made the argument in our reply brief that certain of the judge's findings with respect to the extent to which the expert's testimony was undercut on cross-examination is simply not borne out by the record. But moreover, is troublesome because it seems to conflict directly with what the empirical and scientific evidence tells us. You know, the fact that Mr. Johnson held a menial job at Goodwill, you know, was regarded by the trial court as somehow significant, was regarded by the state on appeal as significant, when in fact it's not at all significant, given what we know about people with developmental disabilities. Borderline mentally retarded, mildly mentally retarded, can be economically productive citizens. There's nothing, you know, particularly stunning about the fact that Mr. Johnson was able to live independently, was able to hold a menial job, you know, was able to, you know, take care of himself more or less on a day-to-day basis. There's nothing particularly stunning about that.
Well, accepting that he does have the mental limitations that you've described, sure. I'd like to understand a little better, specifically in this case, what further steps the police should have taken before they questioned him. I don't understand you to be saying that the police can never question a mentally retarded suspect.
No, absolutely.
And I think he suggested at one point that they should have asked, gone over each part of the Miranda warning specifically with him.
Right.
You suggested that it was wrong for them to have established some sort of a bond or trust, you know, talking about Chicago connections and that. Is the analysis there any different because he was, he had these mental deficiencies? I mean, how does that matter in terms of the police apparently trying to establish a bond with him?
You know, it probably wouldn't matter as much were it not the case that virtually all of the officers that questioned knew in advance that he had mental health issues or developmental disabilities.
Okay, but does that mean they couldn't try to, you know, schmooze with him or shoot the breeze or establish a bond?
However, understanding that there's, and the studies bear this out, that there's a susceptibility, a particular susceptibility to that on the part of developmentally disabled, mentally ill defendants. Really, my focus here is more on the developmental disability, but understanding that there are issues of comorbidity here that are not insignificant. You know, you can look to Kaiser to some degree for some guidance on this. I mean, Kaiser was a case where you had a detective who was apparently trained in administering the Miranda warnings to, I think, children in that case, but you had a defendant in that case who was developmentally disabled or delayed, and that same skill set was brought to bear on the defendant. There was a pause between, you know, the advisement as to each right. There was a, you know, an effort to make each of the rights understandable to the defendant in that case, in a way that accorded with their sort of intellectual level. You know, police will have to be more careful. You know, to the extent that they understand that they're dealing with a defendant with developmental disabilities or mental illness, they're going to have to be more rigorous and careful in their administration of the Miranda warnings. They may need to tailor them in a way that's going to make them understandable to that particular defendant. But again, understanding that what the empirical studies demonstrate and what the expert testified to in this case is that the Miranda warnings as typically given are simply not understandable to some of to many of these developmentally delayed or disabled defendants. There simply has to be a recognition of that in the law. And that's what I'm arguing for in this case. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that, you know, the evidence seems to suggest very strongly that Mr. Johnson was unmedicated at the time of these custodial interviews. He was subjected to, by my count, nearly continuous incommunicado questioning over the course of about 9 hours. Detective Graham admitted that he was deceptive with this defendant, which, you know, courts are willing to countenance to some degree. But again, there has to be a recognition that a defendant like Mr. Johnson, with the mental health issues and developmental delays that he has, that's going to have a tremendous impact on his ability to both understand his rights and to effectively waive them and to give voluntary statements. I'd like to just move on very quickly to what I'll generically refer to as the mental condition statute and the right to present a complete defense. The constitutionality of Section 16.8.107.3b has, as I recognize, been upheld in a series of cases, most recently in People versus Bondurant, which 2012 COA 50, which I don't think either party has referenced as supplemental authority. But I want to be quite clear that the particular issue before this court remains unresolved. And the issue was identified in a footnote in Flippo, and the issue is this, more or less, whether Section 16.8.107.3b and associated provisions violate defendant's right to present a complete defense by conditioning the admission of evidence on compliance with rules that serve no legitimate purpose or disproportionate to the ends that they purport to promote. And here we're dealing with the admission of expert evidence that merely sheds light on a defendant's personal attributes and the circumstances surrounding his or her incriminating admissions to law enforcement. The evidence did not advance any sort of a mental condition defense. It merely provided context and a possible explanation for defendant's statements to the police. As of yet, the state has not articulated what legitimate purpose is served by requiring defendants to give up essential protections and privileges in return for allowing them to do what Crane allows them to do as a matter of constitutional right. In our view, the statute abridges the constitutional assurance of meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense in the manner forbidden by Holmes and Crane.
Mr. Walter, how is your argument different from what was addressed by the division in Bondurant or the other courts that have considered the mental condition statute?
I look closely at Bondurant, and despite the fact that it addresses this issue of the right to complete the right to present a complete defense, it doesn't look like the issue was framed in the manner that it's framed here, which is namely that there's no legitimate reason or rationale for burdening the right to present a complete defense, given the evidence that was sought to be admitted here, which is not evidence that went to mens rea or sought to challenge mens rea or even the voluntariness of the act or whatever. It's simply the sort of evidence that Crane recognized defendants have a right to present, which is to place their statements to police in context and to explain the circumstances surrounding the statements. Why a defendant should have to jump through the various procedural hoops and give up the various privileges that are required to be waived under the mental condition statute in order to present this evidence still has not been explained to me. I can understand the quid pro quo of I'm going to present mental condition evidence that doesn't rise to the level of insanity, and the legislature allows me to do that and challenge the evidence in that manner, but at the same time I'm going to have to give something up. That's simply not what is occurring here.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that even if Bondurant was decided properly on its facts, that this case should reach a different conclusion.
I see my time is up. May I answer, Your Honor?
Sure.
Yes, and understanding that the issue raised in Flippo, but specifically not addressed because it hadn't been raised below in the trial court, still to my mind remains open and unresolved. And I think that there's no tension between the court reaching that issue in this case and going our way and the division's decision in Bondurant.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May I please the court? Paul Kaler, 19210 for the people here. I think that the mental health issue here is a question, is a finding of fact that the trial court made. The trial court found that he was not retarded, that he possessed low average IQ, and he understood the warnings that were given to him repeatedly. And I think also, too, another way of actually looking at this to show that he in fact understood what was before him was that he never said anything inculpatory in these various interrogations or statements with police. He continually tried misdirecting the investigation away from him.
Mr. Keller, if I could back up just a second. We have the use of a lot of different terms here. I want to see if we can agree or maybe not agree as to what the terms are.
Okay.
So you used the term retarded. Do you agree that the defendant here is developmentally disabled?
I don't think so. He was certainly disabled. I don't know. I didn't read that part of the testimony, but he was of low average intelligence, and that he understood what he was doing. And that we have a trial court finding the fact that he in fact understood the Miranda advisements that were given to him. And I think that finding of fact is controls this particular issue. And the defendant brought his own expert in and
said, no, I understand. I'm just,
he could not understand.
I'm just trying to ask a question about terminology because we've also heard the term intellectual disability as well. So I'm not sure what the proper.
We're speaking loosely. He had low average intelligence, is what our evidence showed, and which is what the trial court found. I think it was also, too, from the nature of the various statements he gave to the police officers that he was interrogated with or was having his conversations with, he knew he was the prime suspect in this case. He had to have known that since he made repeated phone calls to his one girlfriend. He threatened to commit the exact type of crime that was here, pouring gasoline on her door and setting it on fire. He knew he was the prime suspect, and he tried misdirecting the investigation away from that. He, in fact, didn't say anything inculpatory at all. He was misdirecting it first to some sort of gang dispute, and secondly, to his cousin Gino. That shows he understood what he was saying could be used against him. He was using it as a means of protecting himself by moving the focus of the investigation away from him onto unknown gang members or onto this Gino character. I think that in fact shows that the defendant was aware and he was using the investigation for his own purposes. I think that shows that he was not, that he had an adequate level of intelligence to understand the Miranda advisement at least. I think it shows a high level. He's also aware that he was had to protect himself against the prosecution for statutory rape because this particular girlfriend was 14 years old when they conceived their child together. He tried leading an investigation away from that. And the record also shows that he was a frequent customer of the criminal justice system. He knew about bond amounts. He knew about his rights. He had been in and out of the system repeatedly. Even if he was a person that had took a long time learning things, he had multiple opportunities to learn that. It's clear that, and as one of the experts said, he said to find that he was very systems savvy. He understood whatever deficits he had, and he had an adequate intellectual capacity to understand what was going on. And he demonstrated that by the content of the statements he gave to the police. Secondly, even if this court were, even if it wasn't bound by the trial court's findings of fact on this, we have the DVD recordings of the last three interviews, and it's clear that in order to make any sort of involuntariness finding or any determination, that there had to have been some sort of coercive governmental activity. As the cases say, that is a necessary prerequisite for making an involuntariness finding. There was just nothing there.
Just apart from this case, just generally, when we have the recordings, you know, the tapes, whatever you call them, to what extent are we then obligated to give deference to the trial court's factual findings?
I think you're still required to give deference to the thing, but I'd say even if this panel were to decide not to give deference, you can look at it again and say, was there any coercive governmental conduct there? And secondly, was the defendant's free will overborne by whatever was said to him? And it's clear that the defendant was pushing his various stories on the officers in an attempt to misdirect the investigation away from him and onto Gino or these other gang people. They were just giving him an opportunity to speak, which he took. He was not being coerced into saying anything he did not want to. And the content is pretty much the same. I guess the very first thing he said, he didn't know anything about the test, but then we started talking with the Officer Cooper and Detective Graham. That's when he started talking about Gino and talking about he was there, and he embellished a little bit more. But he was pushing the story he wanted to tell, which was clearly contradicted by all the prosecution's evidence. Also, on this issue too, I'd like to say, even if the court will find that any or all of these statements were improperly taken away or improperly extracted from the defendant, it would still be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. We have the long number of threats of to commit this particular kind of act. He bought gasoline, he got a lighter from the gas station. That's confirmed by the 7-Eleven clerk, the Good Samaritan who gave him the ride, and also the videotapes at the gas station itself. Then he went off and then he called his other girlfriend and said, I took a gas station there, I was walking down the hall. I lit a match and step outside and you can smell. That's clearly way more evidence than the prosecution needed to convict him, apart from his various statements here. As far as the statutory challenge, I think the obvious intent of the statute is clear. It provides for a fair resolution of the claim on factual grounds, because this is an area of people's mental status, mental condition, whatever you want to call it, where expert testimony is needed to resolve it. It's an area outside the ken of normal jurors, and to provide experts from the prosecution to examine it based on this particular claim, there's nothing unfair about that. It allows the defendant to present his claim if he wants to, but it also allows the prosecution a fair ability to rebut that claim, if possible, on factual grounds and not on sort of guesswork or anything like that. That's all I really have to say.
What is your response to Mr. Walter's argument that the testimony that the defendant wanted to offer here that he believes would come under the mental condition statute is more limited than in other cases?
I can't remember which one, whether it's Flippo or Rocap or Herrera. I think it was Flippo. Said that this is a pretty broad statute. Anything where the defendant is saying, where it concerns the defendant's intellectual or mental ability concerning crime, that allows the prosecution a fair opportunity to examine the defendant to determine if this is true, or to provide evidence contrary to what the defendant is stating. I have nothing else to say. Does the court have any other questions I could try and help it with?
Thank you, Mr. Kaler. Thank you again, Mr. Walton. We appreciate both of your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. And a written opinion will issue in due course.